Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Stephen M. Walt, author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In his newest book, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy, author Stephen M. Walt dissects the faults and foibles of recent American foreign policy, explaining why it has been plagued by disasters like the forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and outlining what can be done to fix it. He proposes a new American foreign policy with a more realistic view of American power. Stephen M. Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He is the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy. He writes frequently for Foreign Policy. Stephen M. Walt, welcome to Reader's Corner.
It's nice to be with you today.
Let's begin by talking about your claim or the point you make at the beginning of the book, which I don't think anybody can disagree with, that President Trump won in part because he claimed American foreign policy was a, quote, complete and total disaster. But your point that it contained many elements of truth. How so?
That's right. It's not the only reason he was elected, obviously. It may not have been the most important one, but his critique of foreign policy and the foreign policy elite, I think, struck home with many Americans, especially given that he was running against a former Secretary of State. And basically what Trump was pointing to is that many of the hopes that we had had when the Cold War ended had been disappointed, sometimes, you know, quite visibly. The 1990s were this period of great optimism where our relations with other great powers were pretty good. Democracy was spreading. Iraq had been disarmed. Iran has no nuclear enrichment capacity. We think peace is coming to the Middle East through the Oslo process. So Americans are very optimistic at this point. Well, you fast forward to 2016 when Trump is running for office. Suddenly we have a bad relationship with Russia and China. Democracy is in retreat around the world. We're stuck in wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that we can't seem to get out of. There is no peace in the Middle East. And globalization, which had been promoted in the 1990s, turned out not to deliver as promised. Financial instability, many people losing jobs in various places. So when Trump turned his sights on the foreign policy elite and said, you know, these guys shouldn't be listened to, they don't know what they're doing, a lot of Americans nodded their heads in agreement.
You refer to the grand strategy of liberal hegemony, which really is basically the old line that's been used for years about America trying to play the global cop. And you point out that there are certain tenets of this grand strategy that presidents over recent years have tried to apply to different corners of the world. What are those for the benefit of our listeners? What are we talking about here that we're trying to export?
Well, it's really more than America being just a global policeman and keeping order in place. It's a strategy of actively trying to spread American values around the world. It's a highly revisionist strategy, which basically says we here in America have the right formula for how to run a country, and we want to make the entire world look more or less like the United States. If I call it liberal hegemony, it's not liberal in the sense of being left-wing. It's rather liberal in the sense of trying to spread traditional liberal values of democracy, human rights, markets, rule of law. And let me just emphasize, I think these are wonderful things, and I'm glad I live in a country where those values are, you know, sacred. The problem is trying to spread it around the world was a failure. It threatened other countries, of course, because we were threatening them with regime change in order to turn them into democracies. When we did manage to topple a government, we didn't get a democracy. We ended up with a failed state because we didn't know how to create democracy in these places. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, globalization. Spreading markets, getting government regulation out, making it easy for trade and investment to flow freely, all of those things, while desirable in the abstract, had real downsides in the way it was implemented. And all of that, I think, came together to make Americans, you know, very vulnerable to Trump's appeal.
As we exported these values, did we really understand the way international politics works and the way other state actors will interpret U.S. moves?
No, I don't think so. And I think there were two fundamental errors. I mean, we forgot about, you know, realpolitik 101, namely that when you are engaged in a vast global engineering project, really trying to reshape local politics in lots of different places, some governments, say the government in Russia, the government in China, perhaps Iran and some other places, are going to be threatened by this, and they're going to find ways to resist. Make that difficult for us. So, in a sense, balance of power politics kicks back in and the United States faces more resistance. Moreover, we didn't understand the politics of some of the societies that we were trying to convert. And so when you topple a thug like Saddam Hussein, you don't end up with a democracy. You end up, first of all, destroying that society's governing institutions, but then creating lots of winners, but also lots of losers. And of course, the losers aren't going to be very happy about being thrown out of power. They're going to pick up guns. They're going to resist in a variety of places. So whether it's Afghanistan or Yemen or Syria or Libya or any of the other places where the United States has been bogged down for a long time, we didn't understand how to create stable democracies, and we ended up creating more trouble than we were solving.
Let's choose a specific example of the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe. First of all, you might help our listeners understand what happened there in recent years, who made these decisions, and then what do you think has been the outcome of that?
Again, NATO expansion was a policy that began in the Clinton administration and initially brought in Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic into NATO. And the idea, and you can understand why this was appealing to Americans, is NATO's a very successful institution. We want to bring countries in Eastern Europe who've now become democratic into this vast alliance. And what was said at the time was that we were going to create a vast zone of peace in Eastern and Central Europe. In a sense, we were going to bring these countries into NATO. We were going to extend a formal treaty guarantee of their security, but that guarantee would never be honored because the whole region would become increasingly peaceful. There were only two downsides to this. First of all, we declared it was going to be open-ended, that any country that met NATO's criteria could join. And this inevitably seemed threatening to Russia. Russia had lost the Cold War, had lost its empire in Eastern Europe, and now the United States, the victor, is progressively taking its alliance and moving it steadily eastward and declaring that there's really no limit to how far east it might go. This, I think, poisoned the relationship with Moscow, and it eventually led to things like the Russian seizure of Crimea and the trouble we're having in Ukraine now. So instead of making countries in Eastern Europe more secure, ultimately it created conflict and made them somewhat less secure. The second problem, of course, is that we thought that that would consolidate democracy in Eastern Europe by bringing these countries into NATO. As I think we're seeing now in Hungary, but also in Poland, the democracy there is not as thickly institutionalized as we would like, and they're now moving back in rather illiberal or undemocratic directions. So even the goal of spreading democracy doesn't seem to have been borne out in our well-intentioned effort to send NATO east.
So let's turn to this issue of America trying to remake its image around the world. And you have a quote. One of the things I really enjoyed about your book is you take names and don't hesitate naming exactly where the challenges are. Your quote is about the blob. Today's foreign policy elite is a dysfunctional cast of privileged insiders who are frequently disdainful of alternative perspectives and insulated both professionally and personally from the consequences of the policies they promote. So I guess, how do you really feel? How can you help us explain this foreign policy elite? I think this is the best part of your book, by the way, and we'll have a chance to delve into this a little bit. But just in general, this is something that I don't think average Americans really understand about Washington, D.C. or New York City or wherever all these folks hang out.
Well, I think this is part of what I was trying to explain for myself, trying to work through this. You know, why did the United States do this, first of all? And then in particular, why did we keep trying to do it? You can understand that, you know, maybe there was this moment of hubris in the Clinton administration at the right after Cold War victory. But once the failures start piling up, once this starts looking harder than we thought, you would have thought we would have adjusted. But even Barack Obama, who was elected, of course, to run a more restrained foreign policy and get us out of some of these wars, found it very difficult. to alter the course here. And it's primarily, in my argument, because the foreign policy elite, sometimes called the blob in Washington, is really strongly committed to this. And by that blob, I mean not just people in government, but also people in think tanks and in foreign policy lobbies, even lots of people in universities who work on these questions. And they basically all have been, or the vast majority, I should say, have been devoted to this idea of the United States being the indispensable nation that should be, in fact, spreading its values around the world. And the quotation you referred to there just captures the fact that this is a group that operates very much on consensus, where there's a set of views that are orthodox and acceptable about American exceptionalism, American leadership, the value of everything that we're doing in the world. Going outside that consensus is not a good career move if you want to rise and prosper in Washington. So people tend to stay within the lines, tend to support these policies even when they're failing, and most importantly, they don't hold each other accountable. So when things go wrong and when people make mistakes and when they recommend bad policies, this has no real effects on their careers. They can just sit it out for an administration and come back in later and make the same mistakes again.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Stephen M. Walt, author of The Hell of Good Intentions. In the book, Walt makes a case for a clear American foreign policy with a more realistic view of American power. So give us a sampling of some of these organizations, these media, the media, whoever else, that really makes such an impact when it comes to opinion making that translates into the policy sitting on some president's desk a few days or weeks later.
Well, first of all, you do want to include lots of people who are in government, who are in the Pentagon, the State Department, Treasury, intelligence services as well. Then I would add that to the vast array of think tanks in Washington, whether it's the Brookings Institution, American Enterprise Institution, Carnegie Endowment, Council on Foreign Relations, etc. And there's dozens of these places where former officials or would-be officials live and work and write papers and articles trying to shape what the government is doing, trying to mold public opinion, things like that. I would then include some members of the media who work on foreign affairs, obviously not everyone, but again, lots of consensus, particularly within what I would call the sort of commanding heights of American journalism, the major networks, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post as well. And the thing about this is a community, right? These are people where, especially at the highest levels, everybody knows everybody else. And therefore, your reputation really does matter a lot. Your career success depends on being seen as smart, well-informed, loyal, reliable, not someone who has a lot of crazy ideas about U.S. foreign policy. And in that sense, this group, this, again, to use the term blob, likes American leadership and likes an ambitious foreign policy because it gives it lots to do, enhances its status. And as I say at one point in the book, it's a full employment policy for this foreign policy elite. Now, I think, to be fair, most people in this elite genuinely believe that this strategy of liberal hegemony is good for America and good for the world. The problem is, I would argue, the last 25 years has shown it's not good for the United States, and it has not been good for many parts of the world as well. Yet, people within that elite refuse to acknowledge that. Again, I think they're very powerfully wedded to it, and they tend not to want to hold themselves accountable.
Share with us how the military, its top command, fits into your argument here. Are they held accountable? Let's talk about Generals Petraeus and McChrystal.
Well, I think the American military, contrary to what some people think, is not primarily responsible for this. They are not sort of pushing actively to get the United States into more wars. There's actually abundant evidence to suggest the military tends to be rather cautious about going into wars. But on the other hand, once we're in, of course, they never want us to leave until we've won. So, General McChrystal, for example, when he was commanding in Afghanistan, basically tied the hands of newly elected President Barack Obama by leaking a report suggesting that if he didn't get 60,000 more troops, we'd lose. And that essentially forced Obama to go ahead and give him not 60,000, but at least 40,000 or so. So the military doesn't like to reduce what we're doing. And the military, along with other parts of the foreign policy elite, does tend to, I think, exaggerate dangers. to convince Americans that there are looming threats in lots of different places and that American leadership and American involvement is going to be necessary to deal with those various dangers. So again, they're not usually the ones who are sort of pushing for us to get actively involved in different places, but they are tending to portray a world that's very dangerous and where the United States can't lower its guard at all or can't even set clear priorities because, you know, there's trouble everywhere and we've got to be ready to stop it almost anywhere it might arise. That's how we get a situation where the United States is still spending more than the next 8 or 10 countries combined on the military, and yet we're told that we're somehow insecure. It just doesn't make sense.
And when it comes to the role of the media, I'd like to touch on that for a moment. Back in the days when we were trying to decide, when the Bush administration was trying to figure out whether to go into Iraq or not, of course, the threat of WMD was hanging over our heads, and that's really what they sold as the reason why they had to go in there, because Saddam had these weapons of mass destruction. You wrote a piece in the New York Times, as a matter of fact, with a number of other scholars claiming, really, that's not true and we shouldn't go in. You can explain that. But there was a guy, Jeffrey Goldberg, at the time, who I think you talk about in your book, who wrote about this. And today he runs the Atlantic Monthly, but he's a good example in your book of somebody who just doesn't get held accountable for some bad calls.
Yeah, so the media picture is a somewhat complicated one. There are plenty of people in the media, reporters, who do, I think, terrific work, and I rely on some of their work because they do, you know, dig into stories and can tell us important things. But do remember, though, of course, when you're dealing with international affairs, a lot of the information we get does come from official sources. Newspapers don't necessarily have a reporter in every place, and they have to rely very much on what they're being told by officials. There are also real incentives for people in the media to cooperate with top officials, because that's how they get scoops, that's how they get leaks, that's how they get exclusive interviews that can get them a big story. So there is something of an incestuous relationship, I think, between much of the media and many of the people I'm talking about. And then I do talk about media, along with the military and other parts of the establishment, as not holding themselves accountable very often. So Jeff Goldberg's one example of someone who wrote an article about links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda that turned out to be completely bogus. There were also other articles written in the Washington Post and the New York Times talking about Saddam's alleged pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. Those turned out to be bogus as well. And with rare exceptions, none of the people who wrote these stories or who, you know, basically made these sort of mistakes had any professional consequences for doing so. I'd say that, by the way, with respect to most of the op-ed columnists who supported the war in various places, and of course, lots of people at think tanks and inside the government as well. It's really hard to point to anybody who was an open advocate of invading Iraq, one of the biggest foreign policy disasters in American history, who suffered any real professional consequences for it. And that's really quite remarkable.
And let's talk about what happens inside the blob when a foreign policy expert is right. And I'd like you to tell the story of the Leverets and what happens to these folks regarding the Iran controversy.
I'll actually give you two examples. So Flint and Hillary Leverett were both what I would call consummate insiders, working for the State Department, working for the CIA, working on the National Security Council, with, you know, distinguished academic pedigrees as well. And they, in the shortly after the Iraq War, you know, sort of came to terms with U.S. policy, decided it was wrong, got out of government, and began doing work in particular on Iran. And published a number of works, had a website for a while, and eventually published a book saying that the United States should attempt to reconcile with the Islamic Republic. And then perhaps most controversially, they argued in a book that, in fact, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad had not, in fact, stolen the 2009 presidential election in Iran, that there may have been electoral fraud, but he would still have won if the election had been completely honest. The point of them is that they were immediately pilloried as, you know, sympathizers of Iran, as possibly being paid by the government of Iran. But if you look carefully at the various things that they said and compare that with what other people were writing about Iran, their track record as analysts is at least as good, and I would argue better, than many of the people who were their critics. My point is not that they were always right. My point was that they got immediately marginalized. You know, they're never going to work in government again, even though their track record was as good as some of their critics. An even better example of this problem, though, is, and I mentioned him in the book, is a former Army colonel, Paul Yingling, who served two tours in Iraq, commanding an artillery regiment, and then eventually wrote an article in an Army journal, signed his name to it, criticizing the senior Army leadership for how they were prosecuting the war. It was about 2005, 2006. This article was hailed as honest, accurate. It was assigned at West Point. It was assigned at the Army's Command and General Staff College. And then the question you want to ask yourself, well, does Colonel Yingling rise in the Army? This truth teller who spotted a problem and pointed it out. The answer, of course, is no. He gets passed over for promotion. He leaves the Army. He's now teaching high school in Colorado, which is, I'm sure, a wonderful thing for his students. But again, if that's what happens to someone who's a truth teller in the military, you're not going to do as well as we would like our military to perform.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Stephen M. Walt, author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. So as you point out, Trump in 2016 and continuing on did touch on some aspects of our foreign policy with which you agree. So 2 years later, help us with your assessment of how that's all played out.
Well, unfortunately, Donald Trump turns out to be not the person who can fix our foreign policy. I mean, it's interesting. Back in 2016, when he ran, he was opposed by the foreign policy elite in both parties. Obviously, Democrats opposed him, but he was openly and, you could argue, even more powerfully opposed by senior Republican foreign policy elites who hated everything he said he was going to do. Now, I think since then, it's quite clear that his governing style as president is completely unprecedented. We've never really seen a president like this. But what's interesting is that the actual substance of Trump's foreign policy is not as different as his Twitter feed or some of his public statements might lead you to believe. We're still in NATO, even though he's been very critical of it. And by the way, his complaints about NATO are not new. Other presidents have said similar things. We still have a very confrontational policy towards Russia. He has doubled down on all of our Middle East allies in various ways. There's no substantial change in U.S. Middle East policy. He started a bunch of trade wars with different countries, but then when he makes a deal with all of them, the new deal is just like the old deal. The replacement to NAFTA is almost identical to NAFTA, so there's no real change there as well. Just like Barack Obama, Donald Trump has sent more troops to Afghanistan, and we've just seen in the last few weeks a kind of on-again, off-again approach to Syria, where he says he's going to pull troops out of Syria, and now he says, well, maybe he's going to leave them there for a while as well. So I'm not saying that there's been no change under Trump, but overall I would argue that the foreign policy elite has been winning as often as it's losing. And I think, unfortunately, we end up with the worst of both worlds. We still have the United States overcommitted in a variety of places without a clear set of priorities or strategy, but we now have a highly erratic, irascible, and I think in terms of foreign policy, incompetent skipper at the helm of the ship of state, and that's not good for anyone.
Mm-hmm. When President Obama was in office, he gave the European Union nation-state status. This is a diplomatic matter that is beyond me, to be honest about it. But recently, President Trump downgraded that to international organization status. I'm just curious what your take is on this. The media made a pretty big deal of it originally. I don't know where this thing's going to wind up. I'm sure it's not going to be on anybody's front page. But your thoughts?
Yeah, he downgraded the formal diplomatic status of the official ambassador from the European European Union, and it's mostly a symbolic action. It doesn't have a lot of substance to it, but it does indicate something that's been consistent of Trump. Trump has, doesn't like the European Union, thinks it's a terrible thing, thinks it's a foe of the United States. None of this is true. And so it's not surprising that he is taking a swipe at it in this particular fashion. This is deeply misguided, and it shows you how Trump's thinking on foreign policy is actually quite muddled. He correctly thinks that the United States should be less engaged in Europe. We should not be spending a lot of money protecting the Europeans, who have all the resources they need to defend themselves if they just would get organized. And he's correct in that regard. Of course, other presidents have said the same thing. We should be doing less in Europe. The Europeans should be more responsible for their own defense. But if that's what you believe, then you actually want the European Union to be healthy, strong, and robust, because it's one of the things that reinforces cooperation and democracy in Europe. You don't want to destroy the European Union, have different European countries start competing with one another, start seeing each other as rivals, because that's the kind of situation where the United States might have to get more involved again. So if Trump really wants to get the United States out of European security and say focus on Asia, focus on China, as I think we should, he should be trying to actually strengthen the European Union. We would like Europe to be the kind of area where we don't have to worry very much about what's going on there, and his policies are a recipe for the opposite.
In your book, you propose a very different grand strategy than the one of making the world safe for democracy and also expanding or exporting our American values. It's called offshore balancing. What is offshore balancing? What's the history of it in our own country, and what's its future as far as you're concerned?
Oh, offshore balancing is, in fact, America's traditional grand strategy, and it goes really back to almost to the founding fathers. The basic idea is what could really threaten the United States, given how secure we are over here in the Western Hemisphere, would be the emergence of another great power that was as strong as we were and that dominated its part of the world the same way that the United States dominates the Western Hemisphere. We have no great power enemies, no real rivals here in the Western Hemisphere. And if some other country was in a similar situation, you know, dominated all of Europe or dominated Asia, that country would be secure at home and would be free to project power around the world the same way the United States does right now. And a country like that could even project it into the Western Hemisphere and threaten the United States directly. This was the concern that led us to get involved in World War I. We didn't want Germany to dominate Europe, and to get involved in World War II. Same thing. Germany was threatening to take over Europe. Japan was threatening to take over much of Asia. So offshore balancing is all about maintaining balances of power in key parts of the world, because for the United States to be the only power that dominates its own region maximizes American security. Well, what does that mean today? Well, the only potential rival to the United States, I mean, serious rival now, is China. So our main goal should be preventing China from dominating Asia and being in a position to project power around the world in other ways. So we should focus primarily on China. There's no country threatening to dominate Europe. Russia is far too weak. The Russian economy is smaller than that of Italy. Russia is far too weak to dominate Europe. So we don't have to do very much in Europe. And similarly, nobody's threatening to dominate the Middle East now. It's as divided as it's ever been. So to the extent that we worry about Middle East oil and gas as a strategic resource, we don't have to worry very much about the Middle East now. We certainly shouldn't be directly involved there militarily. In other words, for offshore balancing right now, we focus primarily on Asia, we get out of the Middle East, and we gradually turn European security back over to the Europeans. Finally, to spread American values, which I do believe in and I think are important, we should do that not with the 82nd Airborne, but we should do it primarily by setting a good example here at home. If we can make our society work better and make our political system work better, that's going to be something other countries want to emulate, will want to adopt voluntarily, not because we're force-feeding it to them.
About the time I was reading that part of your book, which makes the point you're making about no significant enemy or threat in the Western Hemisphere, Russia announced its new hypersonic nuclear-capable missile system, and I wonder if you could tell us whether you think that has any impact on your argument.
No, I don't think so. I think if you look at the condition of the Russian military, which is better than it was, say, 20 years ago, but is not close to being a rival of the United States now, that's not much of a threat. In particular, vis-a-vis the United States and Russia, the overarching point there is that we're deterred from attacking Russia by their nuclear arsenal, and they're deterred from attacking us by our nuclear arsenal. And none of the capabilities that they've occasionally announced, and by the way, whose effectiveness remains to be demonstrated, none of those things are going to alter that fundamental situation. So, in fact, we don't have to worry very much about Russia, certainly not as a direct threat to the United States itself.
So, last question, how do you sell a foreign policy like the one you're proposing? And I'm particularly interested in your comments regarding the state of our diplomacy in America and the need to spruce things up a bit. I wonder if you could address that.
Well, I think Americans do not appreciate the importance that diplomacy plays in our foreign policy. And this has been true for a long time now. We've tended to see security as solely a function of, you know, military strength. I think having a powerful military is essential, and it's even essential for effective diplomacy. But if you think back, many of the major foreign policy achievements in American history were diplomatic in nature. They were things like the creation of NATO. They were things like the Marshall Plan, the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, even the negotiations with the Soviet Union that led to the reunification of Germany and the end of the Warsaw Pact, the peaceful end of the Cold War. These were all diplomatic achievements, not one on a battlefield. And I think that, you know, diplomacy should be the first line of defense of the country, with military force being, of course, the last resort, because it always is costly and it always has unintended consequences. So one of the things I call for in the conclusion is a much greater attention paid to diplomacy. Of course, that's one of the other areas where I think the Trump administration has badly damaged things, undermining morale and effectiveness within the State Department. And I hope the next president, whoever that may be, devotes serious effort to rebuilding our capacity to work with other countries diplomatically, in addition to, of course, maintaining a strong military.
Stephen, I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. This is a must read for our listeners, for anybody out there who cares about the direction America is heading. It's entitled The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy by Stephen M. Walt. Thanks again for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It was my pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.